Welcome to the Stevenson School for Ministry Live. We are the education arm of the Episcopal Diocese of Central Pennsylvania. The Stevenson School for Ministry believes that discernment is deeply important for all of us. Through discernment, we explore the range of ministries in which we, as a body of Christ, can engage. Discernment helps us learn to articulate the places where God is active in our lives through a process of listening, reflecting, and responding in circles of community. And actively engaging in discernment helps us to identify our gifts for ministry while discovering new learning opportunities to serve God and our neighbor. Welcome to the Stevenson School for Ministry. My name is Michael Naylor. I'm the Interim Associate Dean, and I'm privileged to have with me today the Reverend Dr. Gail Fisher Stewart, who is the Interim Rector of St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Washington, D.C. And more importantly for the Stevenson School, she is offering a wonderful course called Repairing the Breach in the spring semester that'll be starting in just a short time. Gail, welcome to the Stevenson School. I know so many people in the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania are looking forward to interacting with you. So,
hi, Michael. How are you? It is truly an honor to be with you today and to have been asked to teach this course. And so I'm really excited about the potential I have to make a difference in repairing the breach in terms of how we see race relations in this country and how the church deals with it. Because we really hear a lot about, okay, we're going to eliminate racism and we are going to have racial reconciliation. But exactly how do you do that?
What does that mean?
Right,
exactly.
Our theology into action. Mm-hmm. Right. And for a lot of people, what happens is the only time they hear the word might be on Sunday morning.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about the project itself of the book? And then I see Mother Shana has joined us, the Reverend Shana J. Watson, the Associate Rector at St. James Episcopal Church in Lancaster. And then I'll ask Mother Shana how she got involved as well. So, Gail, could you tell us a little bit about the beginnings of it all?
It really wasn't my idea. I was on Facebook one day and Canon Stephanie Spellers put a post on that she had read this book called Teaching for Black Lives. And she said, we need to do this for the church. Who's going to do it? And she listed several names. And my name happened to be in the list. And I said, well, let me read Teaching for Black Lives and let me see how this goes. And of course I said, okay, I'll do it. Like, really, you're going to do this, right? So I wrote the proposal to Church Publishing. And when I got the email, start writing, I went, oh my God, now what do I do? And so I thought about how there are many voices within the Episcopal Church who don't have a platform, and how do we bring some of these voices together to really deal with how we preach racial reconciliation, Black Lives Matter, because in speaking to a lot of priests across the spectrum, they said, you know, I can't preach that. I won't have a job. Or I've tried to preach that and people have gotten up and walked out of the sermon. Or I've spoken to lay people and say, with everything that's going on in the country, we've never heard a sermon on race. And so if racial reconciliation is something that the Episcopal Church is keen on doing, how do you have people who've never heard a sermon or who might be afraid of preaching or teaching about it? And so as I was putting this together, we can do a section on preaching, and we can actually have sermons that have been preached, or people will say, I really would have liked to have preached this, but now I can publish it. And the second section was advocating beyond teaching, beyond preaching, how do we put our lives on the line for racial reconciliation across races. And then the last one had to do with teaching, which includes formation in our churches. How do we form? Who are we forming? And also looking at our seminaries. What are they teaching? Just like in many of our universities, if you want to take courses in Black history or Native American, you have to, you know, that's an elective. Isn't that part of the core requirement? So how do we get courses that deal with the beauty that is diversity in our seminaries that are required courses? And that's something that you can pick if you want it. And one of the writers is at the Christian Theological School in Indianapolis, and Frank Thomas, and he has the first and only PhD program in African American preaching and sacred rhetoric. Wow. The only one, right? Mm. And so I ask, well, how many whites would take a PhD in this area? Because you have plenty of people of color who have PhDs and Karl Barth and everybody else, right? So who would, you know, are there people who are white who would say, oh, I want a PhD in African-American preaching and sacred rhetoric, and what do you do with that? So it kind of opens up the discussion of how we truly celebrate the diversity that is within the Episcopal Church and the church at large. And also say that we can be united without erasing ourselves, because sometimes we confuse unity with uniformity. And so we can be united. We can, I can be Episcopalian and still be Black, because I believe in the three, you know, the three legs of the stool. I believe in the creeds. I believe in this, but I shouldn't have to leave who I am at the narthex and become Anglican, which equals white, in order to be an Episcopalian. And we also see that there's a connection with people of color in the Anglican Church and the Church of England. They're having these same conversations where they say to go through the ordination process is to really leave who you are at the steps and become something else, almost like boot camp in the military. We're gonna break you down and then we will create you in our image, because that's the only image that matters. And so the book has, it for some people it was cathartic. Other folks is like, okay, this is my chance. But it offers a platform to begin to discuss how do we celebrate the diversity that is in the Episcopal Church so that everyone can see themselves as being important.
That's wonderful. One of our wonderful voices is on the line with us. And so, Mother Shane, I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about how you got involved with the project, if you will.
Sure. And thank you both so much for allowing me to be a part of this conversation today. Deacon Michael Naylor and the Reverend Dr. Gail Fisher Stewart, it's such an honor. And I consider her a mentor and a big sister in the ministry. So it's indeed an honor for me to speak today and to have participated in preaching Black Lives Matter. The way I got involved in this project was by invitation from Gail. And I don't know if you remember this, Gail, but the invitation came after we went on a pilgrimage to Alabama mm-hmm. on the Ambassadors for Healing, where we visited lynching memorials right. in the South. And so there was about, what, 50 or 60 of us? There was 50, almost
yeah. There were yeah. 50 of us, yeah.
Mm-hmm. From across the nation, who gathered together by trains, planes, and automobiles. We got there. So we visited Montgomery, we visited Birmingham and Selma and all of these places. And part of the message with Gail as our guide and leader for this pilgrimage was, how do we reclaim the sites where violence occurred to Black and Brown bodies as places of healing? And it was just so reminiscent of, you know, the biblical story of the children of Israel getting bitten by the serpents, but their only way to be cured was when a staff was created out of a serpent, and they had to look upon the very thing that was killing them and causing them pain in order to seek their healing. So for us, it was the same. The trip was magnificent. And of course, you know, a year or two later, the pandemic happened, so we weren't able to revisit the possibility of a pilgrimage, but I took away so much from that. And so it was about maybe 3 months or so after that, that Gail sent out the invitation that she was working on this project, and it sounded really interesting. And at the time, I wasn't quite sure what I could contribute, so I kind of sent her an idea about some things that I've been working on and how it might possibly play into that. So most people who know me know that I'm unapologetically Black, but I am also unapologetically a nerd. Like, I am so geeky about comic books and popular culture mediums, and I have done presentations on one pop in theology called From Black Faith to Black Panther, mm-hmm. the evolution of how people of color were depicted in graphic novels, arts, and entertainment from 1830s to the present. So that presentation focused on Jim Crow minstrelsy and the impact of how people of color are presented in both entertainment as well as news media, and how that and how the ramifications continue to manifest themselves, as we see in some instances with law enforcement and policies and discriminatory practices, because at early ages, people are learning about various cultures and how to interact with them, whether it's myth or truth. People process it. And so there's a psychological implicit bias that is occurring that is a part of our socialization. So a huge part of that was what I was able to speak to in the project. And it was quite exciting to see other folks who also participated. Again, it was just an honor and a privilege to be a part of the project. And of course, we incorporated it in Theocon, where theology meets pop culture, and having some of these more deep conversations and difficult conversations through use of pop culture medium. And that's how I like to present some information in the pulpit as well.
The references to Hebrew scripture are so important, it seems to me, and the links that you're making. But there's that element of chosenness that I think we have to talk about. What is chosen to be an Episcopalian these days is white and wealthy and Western and male and straight and a whole bunch of other things. How do we go about disrupting that kind of chosenness to open wide the door, as opposed to, you know, holding things in such confinement?
Part of that has to do with our formation process, which I'm looking into now, because Shana, we both went to VTS and we mm-hmm. had the history of the Episcopal Church, and I think we learned about Absalom Jones, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Learned about Absalom,
and that was about the extent of the
and
Black
his friend Richard.
Until we got to some later things with, you know, UBE and some of the early Black bishops, but we didn't go far enough to say, oh no, we need to start with 1619, and show how. The Church of England, which was also the same as the government, because church was the church, the government, and the government was the church. They were one and the same. And how we know that individual clergy persons enslaved, but when we go back and we find out that vestries actually went to the auction block and tied enslaved to the glebes. And that was a way to entice ministers from England to come to this weird place over here. So you've got tobacco, you've got corn, and you've got enslaved persons. And so to start, to start back there and then bring it up, and that a lot of the laws, because there was this interconnectedness between the church and government, it was the church supporting the laws that said, oh no, you're going to be enslaved in perpetuity, while the European indentured folks serve their 7 years. Okay. But no, this blackness, and it was easy because you could see us. Okay. You could always see us. And so tracing that history up to the revolution, the same folks who were enslavers before the revolution were enslavers the day after the revolution, when the church was disestablished, and all of a sudden now we had the Protestant Episcopal Church, USA, right? United States. Same folks, okay? And so if we bring that up to the Civil War, Black people left the Episcopal Church in droves because they were forced to be Episcopalians because the enslavers were Episcopalian, a large number. They left, but then we kind of came back during the early part of the 20th century because we liked that elitism, okay? Because we were also taught that certain of us were better than others of us. You know, you had the house enslaved as opposed to the field enslaved, and the lighter ones versus the darker ones. And so we had bought into this whole assimilation process. And so we became Episcopalians. My church, St. Luke's, is the first totally financed, built, designed for Black people in what would become the Diocese of Washington under Alexander Crummell, who first was at St. Mary's Foggy Bottom, which was formed by St. John's Lafayette Square for the colored help of those who went to St. John's. Okay. So this is not part of the history, not only in DC, but other dioceses that takes into account how racism has been ingrained in the Episcopal Church. And until you actually acknowledge that, you can't do anything about it. And it's not that we're calling everybody racist, because that's a problem I don't want to deal with, because now you're calling me a racist. We say, no, we're not calling you a racist, but we are all part of and infected by this racist system. And so if we're going to get serious about changing it, we first have to name it and claim it. We got it, as my grandma would say, you got to tell the truth and shame the devil for us to move on. And so as part of the formation process, be it in a seminary or in our churches, how do we tell the history of the Episcopal Church, and what do we include and what do we leave out? Because we don't want to deal with what we consider, oh, that's negative. No difference in the history of the United States. Oh, we don't want that negative stuff taught to our children. We just wanted the glory stuff. Right? But this is what we're going to have to do if we're going to get beyond the racism that has infected all of us.
Dana, does that square with your process of formation and your work through seminary and the beginnings of your ministry as a priest in our diocese?
There are definitely a lot of similarities. And, you know, I'm grateful to Gail and other such pioneers in the ministry who have heavily shaped seminary and curriculum. I only had a year at BTS for my Anglican diploma year, so I did my 3 years at a United Church of Christ seminary in Lancaster. So I would say that many would be proud of and surprised at some of the content that has been reshaped and refocused that that begins at 1619 and further back in discussing the church fathers and how and their Africanness and their connection to the motherland, to say that there is contribution from Blackness and from Black people to the church. Like, it didn't just begin for us when we set foot on the colonial soils of what has later become the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And what I learned during that year in seminary, I feel like I learned more about the politics of the Episcopal Church and its interconnectedness with enslavement and slavery than I probably ever had throughout my entire schooling, from undergrad and, you know, my 3-year degree. Like, I'm sitting there just in awe to learn that, you know, over half the signatures on the Constitution were people who were from the Church of England, who were Anglican. Mm-hmm. You know, we were the Church of the Establishment. And even then, there were schisms in between pro-slavery, anti-slavery, abolitionist work, or anti-abolitionist. Like, there was always this divide within the English church, which later became, you know, as Gail noted, which later became the Episcopal Church USA. But it was just quite fascinating to learn about some of those pieces. And that even now, where it seems like it's very, talking about racism is very new for some people, like, what is still happening? It's like, well, it's been happening. And it's been happening even in our own church. So knowing or learning a little bit more about the history, it's like, guys, we've been fighting over this for years. And the problem is not so much that Black Lives Matter. It's just, it's the problem I'm noticing is that we no longer are wearing physical chains, and white folks don't know what to do with that. Because when the Constitution was written, it was written with Black folks in chains in mind. It wasn't written for freed Blacks. Mm-hmm. But now we're free. Mm-hmm. And and everyone is scared because, like, oh my gosh, you know, we're recognizing that there has been oppression, there's been systemic racism, there has been murders where the murderers never saw a day in trial or are able to walk the streets freely. And now we have these people who are justifiably angry, and what are we going to do with all of that? So I think there's a number of feelings that are happening in light of recent years and where, what to do, where to go with all of that weight of anger and frustration, and how does the church show up for that work, that even now to say that Black Lives Matter or to speak to racism, all of a sudden you're too political or you're too liberal. And when you don't speak about it at all, it's like, well, you're not political enough, or you're not talking about the moral compass of the church community. So there's a challenge in finding the balance or how to navigate. When do you offer pastoral care? Because anti-racism work is grief work. It's grief work for white folks who are waking up to say, like, oh my gosh, I've been either complacent or perpetuating a system that is oppressive and discriminatory to people of color. And it's a grief process for people of color who are saying, oh my goodness, I've been hurt by these things, and I don't know where to go with these feelings or how to talk about them. And it's more important now because I think just within the past 2 or 3 years, racism has been declared a health crisis. Mm-hmm. So this is no longer a passionate conversation about, you know, just the social aspect, like, you know, we matter because, you know, we create great music and food. You know, it's not as superficial as that. Those are important, but it's like, no, these things are impacting the very structure of our DNA. It's impacting how we are predisposed to certain diseases and environments because of redlining, because of environmental racism. It matters because how we are interconnected. When we hurt, everyone hurts. When we're not free, nobody's free. So it's so much, it's deeper than that. And I believe that Gail's book, Preaching Black Lives Matter, speaks to that experience. It enriches our encounter with God and how we see one another's humanity and dignity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And as you talk about the pastoral care part of it, it raises questions that we really don't want to ask. For example, if you're going to be a clergy of color in the Episcopal Church, more than likely you're going to be in a white context. What does that mean? Yep. I mean, I have clergy colleagues. Mm-hmm. Not only are they the only Black person in the congregation, they're the only Black person in the town.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So how do you deal with that trauma? If you're going to be, and we applaud the fact that we have more and more Black bishops, Black female bishops, but if you're going to be a bishop in this church of a diocese, your diocese is predominantly white. How do you engage? Do you celebrate your Blackness, or do you kind of hide your Blackness, or do you know which congregations you can be Black and which congregations you can't be Black? How do you form your staffs? Do you have like underground connection systems where you get together and talk? But, you know, because
a hush harbor.
Right, a hush harbor, right? Because we think that if you are clergy, you ought to be able to fit anywhere. We presume that everything's okay, as opposed to asking, you know, how is it to be the only Black person for miles around? And who takes care of you pastorally? And what does that pastoral care look like?
Mm-hmm.
One of the positive things that the church has done, I think, recently is engaging in the sacred ground curriculum and publishing that widely. I'm involved in one of those conversation circles, and we're about a third of the way through the program. And the most powerful thing so far has been reading Howard Thurman's Jesus and the Disinherited. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that occurs to me again and again as I turn those pages is that this is 70 years ago, and the diagnosis that he made at that time is as fresh then, you know, today as it was then. You know, that if something is seen as normal, this segregation that you're talking about in the church, then all of a sudden it's correct. And if it's correct, it's moral somehow. And if it's moral somehow, it's religious somehow. And the church kind of gets all involved with the upholding of the status quo. And we need to be breaking it open. And I'm not sure I don't know. You tell me. 70 years made a difference. Are his words still
applicable? Are still germane. Yes, there's been progress. But we are called to go further. If we truly believe what we say we believe about the kingdom of God, where everybody has what they need to thrive because God has provided enough for everybody, then we need to be breaking down those obstacles that keep people from thriving. Okay? And to have these discussions, I was with a group of clergy and I said, how many of you pastor a white church? And hands went up. Just that they think they pastor a white church. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Without even thinking, yes, my church is white. Okay. Well, what exactly does that mean? Okay. So, and when you talk about sacred ground and anti-racism training, one thing we have to recognize is that a lot of times people self-select to be a part of those trainings. And the people who really need to be a part of those trainings do not self-select. If we read the book White Too Long by Robert Jones, that talks about the whiteness of Christianity, the whiteness and Europeanness of Christianity, and that it's part of our DNA, how do we change that if we're not willing to admit it and point out and ask, why is your church so white? Why is your church so white? You know, so we have white churches, we have Black churches. Now we're bringing up Latino ministries. We are perpetuating the segregation.
Same thing. Exactly. Exactly. That he was talking about 70 years ago.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, how does the class itself, the Repairing the Breach class that you're preparing, this 10-week experience, how does this seek to address these issues that we've been discussing?
Right. Through reading the book, critiquing the book, and also listening to sermons, Black folks and white folks who are preaching, how to become stronger or more prepared to preach, because it is a risk. It's a risk. Even at a Black church, it is a risk for a Black preacher to preach on race, because a lot of folks, mm-hmm. Black folks, don't want to hear it either. So it is a risk, and are you willing to accept that risk? Because that is what we're called to do. If you look at the prophets did not want to do what they were called to do. But they did it anyway, knowing that there were consequences. But they did it anyway. And so if we don't preach it, because unfortunately, too many people only get their Bible on Sunday from the pulpit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If they don't hear it from the pulpit, then it is not important. And so while you don't have a steady diet of anything other than, you know, the gospel, being able to preach and preach it in a way that makes people uncomfortable, because it has to make people uncomfortable so that they're able to question, like, why is my church like this? Why do I feel like this? That's the only way we're going to repair the breach that is in society. So it gives people the opportunity to critique other sermons, to practice, because one of the things is that they have to develop their own sermon, whether they preach it or not, but they're gonna have to go through the motions of preparing that race a sermon. And also being in community with others as a way of just having a mechanism for catharsis, you know, to vent, to ask questions, to know that there are others in this boat. So it's just the first step. It is just the first step. The breach will not be repaired at the end of these 10 weeks. It's just the first step. We have to go well further, but we do find ourselves in a position where we can be, where we can create brave space and step into that pulpit and preach what needs to be preached in a way that makes sense to people.
One of the topics on the syllabus is gathering strength for the challenge. And I really like what Mother Shana has said about pastoral care for people who are in these situations. And I wonder, Shana, if you could talk about how you gathered strength for your challenges that you face, because, you know, it doesn't, all of us need that hope, all of us need that strength, but I think you are in a unique position that there's some challenges that that really need some addressing.
Gathering strength, I mean, as I mentioned earlier on about the Ambassadors for Peace pilgrimage, for me, that was like the pinnacle of healing work. I always identify that at my core is a pastor's heart. So I always love pastoral care and any type of healing ministry. And I learned from one of my other mentors, Dr. Elizabeth Albrecht Soto, that there are different phases of our lives that we enter into. There's a season of fight, and then there's a season of rest. There's a season of reflection, and then wash, rinse, repeat. You know, you kind of go through these phases. And what I was noticing was that I was always in fight, and it was exhausting me, because the work is an abyss of managing and conversing with people and circle building and reading books and designing curriculums and entering into different groups that are at different levels and different phases of anti-racism / any type of social justice work. And then, you know, there are comments, there are feedback, there's fatigue and frustration on the parts of participants who, with some of our white allies, grow quickly impatient, because, you know, they attended a couple of trainings, they read what's the D'Angelo book, something about white
fragility.
White fragility. They read white They read White Fragility. They had the talk circle for 3 months. And why didn't racism change yet? You know, and I, you know, everyone's tired and like, why is this stuff changing? I'm doing the formula. I'm going to the trainings. I listened to Ibrahim Kendi. I'm doing this. I voted for Obama. Why is it the world changing? And you know, and I'm sitting in these spaces with folks, and you know, I'm feeling all the feels, you know, totally empathizing, and that pastoral piece, how to refresh oneself, prayer, meditation. I do feel like my current setting at St. James is remarkable, and it's not to say that it's perfect, but they strive for a more excellent way. So there's a contemplative community. For example, we're going to be living with the works of Howard Thurman coming up, who is, I personally feel, often overlooked when we're talking or referring to civil rights activists, because we're looking for the folks who were mm-hmm. out in the forefront and with the signs and being blasted with fire hose. And then there's Howard Thurman, who influenced MLK, and he had this approach where, in looking outward, how do we go deeper inward, reflecting on how God is calling us to be as an individual and how to show up in community through reflection, through prayer, through scripture, and through these nonviolent actions. And I find rest in that. I find reprieve in that, looking at sites where violence occurred and responding to some local events whenever there's a local crisis. Part of what one would consider like a clergy response team that would just literally just go and be with people at some of the shootings more recently, well, not recently, but over the past year, and just offering a pastoral presence. People change their disposition oftentimes when they know clergy is in the space, but it has to be a presence of calmness. It has to be a presence of some type of assurance that God is with us and will bring comfort somehow to this situation. But I believe that only comes from time of meditation, time of kenosis, of emptying. You know, we can drink our way through stuff. We can smoke our way through stuff. We can eat our way through stuff, or we can go a more productive and healthier route and simply just be on our knees and pray through it and reflect through it and talk to God and tell God how uncomfortable this feels and how we think it's unfair. And he is absent. Be angry, embrace all of it and let it go, because we have to refresh ourselves and to be prepared for more conversations such as these. I feel like if we're all stuffed with emotions that we don't know what to do with it, that's not productive, and we're at risk of burnout. We're at risk of heart disease, heart failure, stroke, you name it. So there are all these other physiological aspects to the importance of pastoral care and meditative practices and contemplations and yoga. We need the physical release, right? I have to confess, I'm not a yoga person, but you know, I will walk around the block. I will walk. Gail, how about you? What practices are you implementing these days?
You know, and I listen to you, and you are very pastoral. And I can be pastoral. I'm called to be pastoral. I look at how is our worship service, our worship, mm-hmm. how do people experience worship? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so it's February, so we pull out all the Black history stops, you know, we change the frontals on the altar, the cloth, and as opposed to, why can't we do this throughout the year? You know, put the heavy brocade away, let's bring in the culture of the people who are there. Let's look to see whether or not our liturgy is includes everybody who might come by our church in terms of the music or the reading or the art in the church building. How do we do this to reflect again the diversity that is there, as opposed to funneling everybody into whiteness. And then certain months, then we, let's open up and celebrate this and celebrate that. But then we go back to whiteness. And so coupling the pastoral, and that's part of pastoral care. How do people experience worship? How do they leave worship? How, you know, are they transformed by the worship experience? And what does that look like? So all of this is included in repairing the breach, and again, focusing on the unity that is in difference as opposed to uniformity. Okay? We can be there. I shouldn't have to kill a part of myself to be Episcopalian. I shouldn't have to kill who God has created me to be Episcopalian. And so if we lift up that as part of our pastoral presence, no, bring your whole self to the worship experience, and you will see yourself somewhere in this. I'm thinking about the vestments for the new bishop. Is it Oregon? And again, her name is, she was just consecrated over the weekend.
Yes. Yeah, right.
Right. If you look at her vestments, her bishop's vestments, yes, they are vestments we have seen forever, Cope, Chasuble, Stole, but they look totally different because they bring in her culture, which is Asian. And instead of the normal vestments that look like they weigh the people down, she looks like she can take flight. And awesome. As opposed to the crosses and the sheep and the crowns, her family's crests are part of her vestments. Now, there's some traditional go like, that's not right. You know, that's not right. But it's her. It's her. And rather than looking like she's weighed down, she does. She looks like she can take flight because her vestments celebrate her culture and also the culture of her diocese. So it's a lot of outdoorsy things. So she has on the proper stuff, but it looks totally different.
Yeah.
Because of who she is. And so why can't we do that in all of our parishes? You know, how do we bring in the culture of the people within our communities and celebrate the nature that is within our communities in our church settings to make people, this is about me. This is about me and my relationship, as opposed to, no, I have to leave myself at the door and become white.
That gives me some hope. And that's what I've been looking for in all of this. I look forward to more interaction with your book and with the diverse voices that are in there. And I look forward to hearing about this course and how it plays out, because the syllabus looks so exciting and looks like something that I hope everybody takes the opportunity to join in. So I want to thank Mother Shana for being with us today, Shana Watson from St. James in Lancaster. And I want to Reverend Gail Fisher Stewart for being a part of this broadcast. The time is right, I think, to address these issues with diverse voices, as you said. And that's why the nature of the book looks so great and the nature of the syllabus looks so exciting. So I want to thank you for your time today. And I don't know, you have any last thoughts you want to leave us with, Gail?
We've done a lot, but there's more to do. And eventually, you know, how we when people die, we say we want them to rest in peace. Why must you die to have peace? Why can't we have a little peace here on this side of the Jordan? You know, why can't we really be who God has created us to be and celebrate that? And I think that without the church kind of I don't know, infecting society, because sometimes the church likes to infect society. We can't affect society, but we first have to get our own house in order before we tell other folks how to get their houses in order. And this is everything we've done. It's just a great start. And as I said, I am looking, I am excited about being asked to teach this particular course. So I thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you on behalf of the Stevenson School and on behalf of the diocese.
Thank you for joining us today. If you'd like any more information on the Stevenson School, please visit us on the website of the Episcopal Diocese of Central Pennsylvania, found at diocesecpa.org, and check out the tab for the Stevenson School for Ministry there. Blessings until we meet again.